Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. It is Monday, July 17th, 2023. If July 17th, if that rings a bell with you, it was July 17th of 1990. It was July 17th of 2014 when Malaysian Flight 17 was shot out of the sky. But domestically, for the United States, it was July 17th, 1996, when TWA Flight 800 went down. And if you remember that time, folks, you remember how many questions people... Remember like 700 people said they saw a missile go up in the air and then they were discounted. The FBI took over the investigation and, oh, it was like a crime scene. And then the CIA rendered this funky drawing... the aircraft actually climbed after a center fuel tank explosion. Okay, again, you know, I sit back and I just wonder how many lies that the American people and really the thinking people of the world are going to take before it ends. I'm going to show you this video clip from that time period, short clip, and then I'm going to bring on a very special guest. My guest today, he was in studio, a week or two ago? I can't remember. I'm like Joe Biden, I think, at the moment. No, not sniffing hair. Don't do that. And no, not chomping on kids. No. Or fingers. No. 20 years after, before I get to the film, 20 years after TWA went down. And understand, there were 230 people that were murdered, okay? 212 passengers, 18 crew members. And I want to just say this. If you've ever had a violent death of a family member, all right, it changes your life. It changes everything about you. 20 years after the event in 2016, Jack Cashel wrote this book. I'm a big fan of books. And this just came out in paperback. Oh, even though I've got the hard copy, I'm going to get the paperback. And I'm going to give it away because it's so relevant today. The findings are relevant today. But he was on last week or the week before. It was the week before. Untenable is his book. If you want to flash Untenable up there, I'm sorry to make you go back and forth. If you haven't gotten his book, Untenable, the true story of white flight from America's cities, I'm going to tell you what, this book is just a tremendous read. It explains what is going on today. Get it today. Rate it. Give it 5 stars on Amazon. Leave a comment. You don't have to mention my name, of course. But no, I'm serious. It is one of the more comprehensive books, in my view, about why things are taking place and who's behind it is I'm telling you what. And it kind of fits right in with Michelle Obama when Joel Gilbert was on Michelle 2024, that book as well. But the focus of today, this TWA 800. Let's go back in time, shall we, to July 17th, 1996. Solemn, solemn memories indeed. Check this out.
Good afternoon. We'll update the TWA crash story and join the Oprah Winfrey Show in a couple of minutes. First, the very latest on the crash of Flight 800. Federal safety officials and the FBI and New York City law officials have been all over the scene in the Atlantic Ocean, some 10 miles south of East Mauritius on Long Island. There have been reports from a New York congressman that one of the plane's flight recorders had been found, but investigators so far are denying that report. We also know that 16 students and 5 teachers from Montoursville, PA, a small town upstate near Williamsport, were on that plane, and 4 people with ties to the Channel 6 viewing area were also on the plane. More than 100 bodies have been recovered. Officials say there's virtually no chance that anybody survived. And the latest TWA report indicates 210 passengers and a crew of 18 were on the plane. Now, we have several live reports to bring you. First, John Rawlins is in East Mauritius, which is the on-ground headquarters for the search mission. That's only 10 miles from the crash. John, what's the latest there?
Well, Mark, the rescue effort here has pretty much become a recovery effort, as you said. I think hopes are fading that they will find anyone who survived this crash. The Coast Guard is using 27 boats, 5 helicopters, and 1 long-range search plane at this point in time. Their search pattern covers about 240 square miles, about 10 to 15 miles behind me out in the Atlantic Ocean. Now, we did hear from the NTSB's Robert Francis a short time ago. He says that despite the unusual circumstances, meaning the fact that so many people saw a fireball in the sky last night, the status of this investigation is still that it is an accident. We have learned really precious little about Flight 800 at this point and why it fell from the sky. We are told, though, that at this point there is no evidence of any criminal act, no evidence that an explosive was used at this point. However, the FBI is certainly looking at it. The final tally, or at least I should say the current tally on bodies found at this level, is that 104 bodies have been recovered, 2 have been identified, 10 have been tentatively identified. Many pieces of the aircraft have been found, including one up to about 30 feet in length. There appears to be some charring, certainly evidence of a fire. Some confusion, as you said earlier, some confusion as to whether the flight data or the flight voice recorder has been recovered. A local congressman here said earlier today that they had found that recorder, at least one of those recorders. Now we are told by the NTSB that there is no evidence of that. I'm John Rawlins, live on the Action Cam in Long Island. Mark?
John, before you go, there are people, of course, around here with connections to the crash, and, of course, people all over the country wondering what arrangements are being made. They're calling TWA. As far as you know, what is being done with the families, with the victims' remains? What exactly are they doing now?
Well, the last we heard is that the families are being brought to JFK. They're being kept in a hotel there outside of JFK. The bodies that are recovered are being brought back to a Coast Guard station not far from where we are right now. A temporary morgue has been set up, and they are being able to transition the bodies from there to a morgue inland. And there, we understand, will be where the identification of the bodies will take place with the families involved.
All right, John, thanks very much. John Rawlins live in East Mauritius with the latest from the scene. Now,
does that take you back? Yeah. Jack Cashel is with me. Jack Cashel, the author of numerous books, including, if you haven't gotten already, Untenable. That's his latest book, latest work. Please, please, please grab yourself a copy of that on Amazon. I've got to tell you, it's worth the read. It's good. It's a good summer read, and it explains what's going on in American cities, as well as now the paperback edition of TWA 800, of which 27 years, I mean, from 27 years ago today, the takedown of TWA 800, it just boggles the mind when you think about 230 people having their lives snuffed out. Jack, thanks for coming back, my friend.
Oh, no, my pleasure. And, you know, just watching that news clip alerts me to some of the things that were already going on. And that seems to be the day after, or no more than 2 days after.
Yeah.
But already, here's Robert Francis, the NTSB, total political hack, by the way, saying, oh, you know, we know it was not a bomb or a missile. You know, we know it was an accident, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you know it's an accident, what's the FBI doing on the scene? Because the FBI can only be called in when they're suspicion of foul play. So you see them, the conflicting elements of the story already banging heads against each other. The other one is the notion of the black boxes, the voice, the data voice recorder and the sound recorder, and the digital recorder. They were, my best evidence suggests they were indeed found on day one. They were hard to miss. You know, they let off these pings and they're only 10 miles offshore, 100 feet of water. They would easily be retrieved almost immediately. Best evidence suggests they were retrieved by Navy SEALs or some special naval squadron and doctored. And then put back in place. So when they're finally found, like about 10 days later, the black boxes are orange, by the way. They're fluorescent. They're sitting there on the ocean bottom, like the hassock in your living room. You know, you or I could have found them.
Yeah.
And then they were both curiously missing the last several seconds of their telltale evidence.
Why does that always happen? I mean, you know, it's, hey, Epstein, the cameras were out. I mean, you know, it seems like all this happens.
You're actually right, Doug. And you know what they count on is for us to presume incompetence rather than conspiracy.
Right.
And with the government, you know, you never know where one begins and one ends.
Unbelievable. I mean, you know, when I watch, and I remember watching this in real time, I was doing a lot of investigative work in New York City on Long Island, around that time. And then after that time, and I got to see the memorial that's out there, that went out there. But anyway, the talk was when I was out there that, I mean, you had, I think, 38 out of 300 people said, we watched a missile fly up, okay, from somewhere, you know, from the horizon. And I spoke to a hotel clerk when I was staying out there who actually was at the beach, not too far from where this happened, who said, right. Absolutely. There was something that came out of, she said came out of the water, but.
Off the horizon, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The way they would have seen it, yeah. Yes. I know the numbers are higher than that. Of course, the FBI interviewed more than 750 people who saw something.
Yes.
Roughly 255 of them saw an object ascending towards the aircraft. Something like 96 of them traced that object from the horizon right up to the plane. Several of them gave startlingly accurate reports of the breakup sequence. And one woman, I start my book by my conversation with this woman. We'll just call her witness number 73. And one day she calls me out of the blue, and this is about 2009, I think. And she says, I'm witness number 73. Do you know who I am? She says to me, challenging me, because I'd already written an earlier book on the subject. And I said, yeah, you're upside down Nike swoosh, right? Yeah. She goes, yeah, that's me. Her,
I remember
her
that from the book.
Yeah. By, you know, the FBI, first of all, the FBI, here's where incompetence enters. Their guys don't know anything about aviation. I don't know anything about nautical observations, anything. So they just send them out there with their little code books, their 302s, and they take notes. But this woman gave very accurate description because she was an aviation professional. She was watching it on from the beach. She tracked it from the horizon, rising, ascending, a red glowing point, a gray smoky contrail, zigzagging, arcing over at the end like an upside down Nike swoosh at its as it found its target. Hitting the right wing, you know, the knocking that off, the nose falls off. She described the breakup sequence perfectly. So when we were talking, I said to her, well, why did you change your story with that second interview where they said you had been drinking Long Island iced teas and you weren't quite sure what you saw? And she goes, well, about that second interview, first of all, she says, I don't even know what a Long Island iced tea is, right? And then I said, well, might you have been drinking something other than a Long Island iced tea? She goes, no. She goes, because I don't drink at all. Then I said, then she says, there's something you need to know. And I said, what's that? She goes, there was no second interview. They made it up out of whole cloth. And then I said, there's something you need to know. And she said, what's that? I said, you are one of at least four key eyewitnesses for whom, likely the CIA, fabricated a second interview that never happened. And in each case, the eyewitness changed his story just enough so that the CIA could deny that they really saw much of anything.
Now was that the CIA or the FBI in the 30,
And the 302s are the FBI.
Right. That's the FBI.
Right.
Okay.
So the first 302 on Witness 73 was legitimate.
Right. Okay.
The second 302, I believe, was manufactured by the CIA.
There we go.
Putting it together. I've seen it, the copy of it. I mean, it exists. It's a tangible thing. But, for instance, one of the people for whom the CIA doctored information was a fellow named Mike Wire. I had lunch with him on Saturday. I do every year at this time. And his wife, he was CIA witness number one. They built their animation around his perspective. And he was a millwright working on a bridge in West Hampton. And, he saw everything. And so they, they have the, it's odd because they released some information that, lets curious people know that there's something wrong here. So at this point, the CIA analyst, I believe his name is Randolph Taus, he was being interviewed by someone from the NTSB. It was just a legitimate inquiry into what happened. And he said, we have this 302 from this guy, Mike Wire, and it says that he saw it come off the horizon, it's exhaled up, blah, 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 exact scenario. And yet that doesn't factor into your animation, the animation they created in which a fuel tank explosion breaks the nose off the plane. You talked about it, Doug. And then the plane turns upright like a rocket and soars 3,500 feet into space, confusing people into thinking they were seeing missiles, right? That was the story they pushed. But this one NTSB guy, an honest guy, said, that doesn't square with what Mike Wire's 302 is. So what the CIA guy says in this interview is, well, we went back in and realized that he didn't, when we talked to him the second time, he realized that he didn't quite see that. He really picked it up, the object up about 20 degrees off the horizon. And that was almost assuredly TWA-800, So that was crazy. And they just made it up for him, too. But they didn't create a 302 for him. They just made it up. And in this interview, they revealed they made it up.
So, are you telling me that our investigative bodies, national investigative bodies, are just nothing but, I mean, they're making up stories about this? I mean,
can you believe that? Can you believe that they would suppress evidence before a major presidential election to allow one particular candidate to win? Who would have thought something like that in 1996? Well, we were naive in 1996.
I'm glad you mentioned that. We were naive in 1996. A lot of people were, and a lot of people are waking up to the fact that, man, we've been lied to so much. And it's people like you. It's investigative journalists, reporters, authors like you that bring out the truth. And if you seek the truth, folks, and again, TWA 800 coming out in paperback this week. Grab yourself a copy of this. Never forget. We talk about the incident, but 230 families affected by this. Okay, the sports team from upstate Pennsylvania here. I just remember just how sad it was. But for the victims and for the truth, folks, TWA 800 coming out in paperback this week. And,
right, Doug, I visited with at least one of the family members from Montoursville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It was a French club. And there were 16 students and five teachers, 21 killed in all. And it's a small, cute little town in the middle of the state. And it was tragic. The town never recovered. It's just, you don't lose 16 of your students in one moment and just in a flash. And what happened is the fellow I was communicating with, Don Nybert, who's a pretty technical guy, and he dogged the NTSB and the FBI for information for years because he was the one, as a family member, he had access to certain information that you and I might not get. And it was he who brought in an audio expert to examine the cockpit voice recorder and the data recorder. And it was his guy who said, hey, we're missing 4 seconds off the end of each of these, right? And so they did that things. And then they said there were 3 satellites operating, but they were all defunct at that time, too. They weren't working. It's, you know, you're right. Back to Jeffrey Epstein in his jail cell. Yeah. Nothing is working when you need it to be, right?
Yeah. And you know, one thing, when I was going through the book again, it's been a while since I read this. So this weekend, I sat leisurely by the pool. I'm kidding. I sat in my office and I was reading this book and rereading it. And the amount of information, the ability that you've got to draw people in the know into your venue. I mean, it's incredible how people open up to you and how people are, and how you track people down as well. So, I mean, yeah. The fantastic read. And again, thank you for making a paperback from this book. Okay, you mentioned one thing earlier, and it kind of, when I was reading this too, it kind of stuck with me. Going back to 96, presidential election coming up.
Right.
The gay 90s. I mean, it really wasn't bad, right? We didn't think it was nothing. Everything was going great. And Clinton in the White House. Ah, he had the blue dress and all that stuff. Well, you know. Whoops. But anyway, what the hell happened, Jack, and why? I mean,
and this is what's an overlooked story, and that is that 95 and 96 were the two most corrupt years in American political history. And it's hard to believe that they could be more corrupt than the last bunch, but Clinton, at least from the presidential standpoint, in 94, if you remember, the Congress turned both the House and the Senate. Clinton got a massive shellacking. He lost, 40-something seats in the House and lost control of the House for the first time in 40 years. And the media panicked. You know, as long as they had the House, they figured they were, they had some comfortable level of control over the flow of events in the United States. And they lost the House. They lost the Senate. Clinton was under the gun. There were, serious talks of people challenging him for the primary that year, Democrats. And then, with the help of Dick Morris, he went on this incredible fundraising campaign, largely through foreign sources, much of it from China. They gave away state secrets, they sold them. He and Sandy Berger was his chief salesman, for a dollar and a dime. And they raised enough money and they circumvented all of the electoral laws to run their own campaign, outside of the normal channels. And Morris brags about it, at least the campaign. He swears he has no knowledge about TW 800, although I cornered him once on a show. And three times he acted like he didn't hear what I was saying, literally. We're both calling in. It's like there was an impediment. So coming into the election cycle, and this is it's kind of interesting detail, and I find the detail. He had one golfing buddy on the PGA Tour. Clinton liked to golf. But the PGA was a highly and still is Republican association. And his one buddy was Greg Norman, who was the Australian, and he was obviously a top-line golfer.
Right.
But in the 1996 Masters, this is going to sound totally off the wall, but it's relevant. Norman takes a 7-stroke lead into the 96 Masters and loses it,
Okay.
So from then on, Clinton would walk around saying to his staff, Greg Norman, Greg Norman, Greg Norman. We cannot be Greg Normanized, right?
Wow. I didn't know that.
1996 comes and he has a Greg Norman moment. His poll numbers are good. It looks like he's on track to win. But then he has the ultimate Greg Norman moment. And Clinton, his greatest vulnerability is as a military leader. I mean, he's a draft dodger. At that time, that mattered. And the military hated him, and they didn't trust him. At that time, we could trust the military. so when that moment happened, they went into panic mode. And not only did they call in the FBI on day one, but unbeknownst to the FBI, they called in the CIA on day one. CIA had absolutely no business with this.
I was going to say, now, what was the reason for doing that? Because obviously, there had to be some suspicion of potential nefarious activity from outside adversarial sources, right?
That's right. There's no doubt that they knew on that night that a missile had taken out the airplane. Now, they here is a small number of people, I will say. It's not like a whole lot of people. That night also, and this was much to their chagrin, one amateur videographer captured the whole thing, the whole sequence on video. There was an instant bidding war for his video. The winner was MSNBC, which had been on the air for only 2 days, right? That wouldn't happen now, but at that time, MSNBC bought it and they showed it. I've talked to, Doug, 100 people who saw that video. And I've also spoken with, through an intermediary, the person who was working at MSNBC when the FBI came and seized all copies. One of my best sources is a guy who's a 747 pilot who is laid up in a Hong Kong hospital. And he also worked for Boeing before that, so he knows his stuff. And he and his wife, he had a back surgery. He was in Hong Kong. His wife was with him. And in Hong Kong, they ran that video over and over. He said he saw it 100 times, right?
Wow.
Just a couple of years ago, I was working with some friends at Judicial Watch, and we tried to run the video down in Hong Kong without success. So that existed. They knew it. I talked to the guy manning the screens at the Air Traffic Control Center who saw the object approaching Flight 800. They knew it. So they brought in the FBI illegally because according to the law, this is not just custom, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, has control of a crime scene until they say, we believe there's suspicious activity, and they call in the FBI. But the FBI was on the scene day hour one. They were totally involved. But behind the scenes, the CIA was really calling the shots. So for this book, the 2016 book, TWA 800, we got a hold of this motherload of CIA data, documentation from their own source. This is hard evidence, where the CIA analyst number one, he got an award for this. His name's Randolph Taus. I don't know what he's doing now, but he writes in his memo to his bosses, and at that time, if you recall, the head of the CIA was a Democrat. It was George Tenet, a political guy, and saying, listen, the FBI missile team claims they talked to 144 excellent eyewitnesses to a missile strike. This is in the first 2 weeks after the crash. And we dissuaded them from going public with that information, right? So the message the FBI got was for the first 5 weeks of the crash was to suggest that a bomb was responsible. And the evidence, veered in that direction. On August 23rd, now we're talking, at least 5 weeks after the crash, the evidence, the headline above the fold, the New York Times, was prime evidence found that explosive device in cabin destroyed TWA 800, right? They're pushing a bomb bomb theory. Above the fold left on the New York Times that day was Clinton signs welfare reform bill on eve of Democratic National Convention. One of these stories had to go. So for a month later, the FBI now finessed a mechanical failure as the cause of the crash. And the CIA, and then they yielded to the CIA the responsibility for finding a plausible explanation for the 250 people who thought they saw a missile attacking the airplane. Some of the military, pilots.
I mean, fishermen. People would know. I mean, people who would know.
Who would know? Right. Yeah. 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 And, the two National Guard helicopter pilots who saw it, who went public on day one, not knowing they weren't supposed to, and then got scolded, into silence. So that there's a ton of information available. They had, you know, hearings went on for 4 years. And before they finally closed the case, the NTSB was totally corrupt at the top. They had Clinton, the head of the NTSB at the time, was a guy named Jim Hall, who was a Al Gore toady from, you know, Tennessee, whose previous, you know, experience with transportation was probably failing his driver's license test. And at one point, I think it was on the fifth anniversary, Doug, of the crash, 2001, I was scheduled to debate Jim Hall on CNN, right? And I said, that, you know, people say, are you ready for this? This should be fun. I said, there is no way they could put Jim Hall up against me. They will not do it.
I remember our first interview, you talking about this. I remember this. I love, folks, listen carefully. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I love this. Go ahead.
I was sitting out that day thinking about what I was going to say. I realized what I was going to say. I realized that within 1 minute I could humiliate him and dismantle the whole case. And then I realized I'm going to get a call within the next hour telling me this is off, right? And I did. I got the call. I wasn't even surprised. You know, well, sorry, Jack. The producer was really upset because she was a straight shooter. And she said, my bosses said that, you know, that... you were, they could not trust you, something like that. You, I was not, what was the word? I was not a responsible journalist, right? Responsible. And so we decided instead just to have Jim Hall on.
You know? That'll work.
And then he gave his, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. He's like having, you know, Joe Biden talk about it. You know, he's just blabbering. Their number two guy, Bob Francis, was also totally political. Now, there's a wrinkle in this story, and it's the FBI. The CIA totally in the tank. The FBI wasn't totally in the tank. They were being torn. I don't know exactly what forces were brought to bear to make the FBI toe the line. The one guy I know, one very good guy involved in this, I learned of only after my book came out in 2016. And you get these interesting emails from people, right? And they'll say, listen, I can't identify myself, but I work for Raytheon. Raytheon's being sued now. They were the makers of the drone that was involved in the missile test that went awry. And he said, you really need to talk to the head of the FBI missile team, right? Uh-huh. And I said, who is that? And he said, you mentioned him in the first few pages of your book. He wouldn't say anything more than that, right? So I'm just going to call him Steve for now. He's a really good guy and a straight shooter. And I finally found my way to him. He wasn't eager to hear from me because he had gone public before September 11th about the wall between the CIA and the FBI and how it caused them to miss the one of the main subjects.
Oh, and the Gorelick wall, yeah.
He was written up in the Gorelick wall, who was Gorelick was running this investigation here in 96 as well. And so when I got a hold of him, I knew that he had been written up in the New Yorker, and he got out of the FBI soon afterwards. And when I talked to him, he was out of the FBI. And he said, Jack, he goes, you know, I admire the work you're doing. You're totally on the right track, but I got a new family and a new job. I got to keep quiet about what I know. But he was the guy who was reporting that the missile team was reporting that these eyewitnesses were excellent. They knew what they were talking about. And then he got involved. He was the only one in that whole hierarchy to stand up to the CIA and say, this is wrong, what you're doing. And I have the documents of their conversations with the CIA. They're all from the CIA perspective. So they're saying, well, we finally convinced them or whatever. No, but he was never convinced. He knew that what they were doing was wrong. But he had already blown the whistle. You know, he was by this time, by the time this all came out, he was already involved in the 2001 case. And he's never gone public. So and there's probably not enough he could say that would turn any heads. Other than to tell them that the entire investigation was corrupted, and the New York Times was part of that. They didn't want to know that.
Well, I don't even know how to phrase this question. From the time you began looking at TWA 800 to today, the evolution of lies, the evolution of the process of the lying by the government, are you surprised at how rapid or how rabid, I suppose is a better word, this lying has been? I mean, to the
The word I would use, Doug, is brazen.
Brazen. Right? Yeah, that's a good word. Brazen.
They don't even care if we know. You know, they used to try to conceal their dirty work, right?
Right.
You know, an interesting case in this is the case of Jim Kallstrom. And I may have told you this story before, but it's
kind
of funny.
Yes.
In its own way. Jim Kallstrom was the head of the FBI investigation from day one. Everyone who meets him just called him a bully and profane. But he was well-respected within the FBI. He's a very technical guy in terms of, like, bugging devices and that sort of thing. And so he was at that at the New York office, and, you know, he was heavily involved in bringing down the mob and stuff. And yet, when he took over this investigation, he was, I thought he was tormented. Well, coming into the fall of 2016, he's now on Fox News as their security analyst, and he's clearly anti-Trump. I'm sorry, anti-Clinton, right? Clearly anti-Clinton. In fact, he comes out and actually endorses Trump on the air as a security guy, right? So I send him a classified letter, and because I have no direct access to him, but our friend Susan Daniels got me his address. And I sent it to him in Connecticut, where he lives. And I said, listen, I hear from victims' families every time you're on the air, and they're seething. They said, you know the truth. You know that the truth about TW-800 could bring Hillary Clinton down. And so I vote absentee, and I go to France for a couple of weeks to avoid the hubbub around the election. And I'm sitting out. These details matter, actually. Okay. I'm sitting out on the in Nice, overlooking the Mediterranean, right? I'm sitting on a bench, a bunch of French people there. And I get a call on my cell phone. It's from Connecticut. I go, who is this? And it says, are you Jack Cashel? And I said, yeah. He goes, what the effing, do you think you're effing? You know, I mean, and one F-bomb after another. I mean, I was being cluster bombs with Fs, you know. It's like, and so I got him to calm down a little bit. He says, are you telling me that terrorist missiles took down this airplane? I said, no, I'm not telling you that. I'm telling you that, unfortunately, I would like to have believed it was terrorist missiles, but the evidence overwhelmingly points to a naval misfire. Oh, you sound, then he goes on. Here's where it gets kind of bizarrely amusing. He says, you sound like that effing Pierre Salinger. He held a press conference on the effing French Riviera telling the world that the Navy took down that aircraft, you know? And I'm thinking to myself at the time, thank God he doesn't know where I am. If he knew I was on the French Riviera, right? He would think for sure there's some French conspiracy involved. But no, he sounded a little, I'd say, a little drunk. I know he was, I think he had cancer at the time. He since died. But a day later, he called. I pick up the phone. It's Kallstrom, right? And I was hoping he had a change of heart. He was like now sobered up, wanted to tell me the truth, like some last minute confessional. But no, he butt dialed me.
Okay.
Anyhow, so the truth went to the grave with Jim Kallstrom. I'm not sure he knew it. When he talked to me, what surprised me is how little he knew. How could he not have known about my book if he cared about this subject? Or my other video, or my book with James Sanders on. He had to have known. And now he's like making believe that this is coming as news to him? Naval misfire? You know, like it was just something that Pierre Salinger dreamed of?
And by the way, folks, that Pierre Salinger clip, I watched that this morning. You can see it on YouTube. Yeah, very interesting. And the time I had forgotten where you were when you got that call. Oh my gosh! You can't make this stuff up.
But, oh no, it's too crazy.
So what you're saying, okay? And this gets me. I mean, you know, if my daughter would have been on board, Or my wife or someone I really cared about. I mean, I would turn over heaven and earth to find out what the hell happened.
Right.
And you know, it we owe it to the people who died that day, I believe. And we owe it to each other that the truth does come out. And by the way, folks, TWA 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. One of my favorite people on the planet, Jack Cashel, and perhaps one of the most intelligent people on the planet, Jack Cashel, and a great investigative reporter and author, writes books like You're There. I mean, it's great. The paperback is out, and order it today, as well as Untenable, his latest. That's really a great book too. I love books. Hey, your summer reading, again, get it and go by the pool and get some education. But Jack, I mean, I don't even know what to ask anymore, except are we ever going to be, when's the truth going to come out? Is it ever going to come out?
I don't know. I had some hope in these lawsuits that Tom Stalkup, a physicist, a no-nonsense guy who's been hounding this since it happened, and he's doing it for no other reason than he's a truth seeker. Politically, I don't think we're on the same page. And he's a technical guy, so he's focused on the radar, which to him is the smoking gun. He's made a lot of headway. He's representing these victims' families, to your point. You know, some victims refuse to let this die. And he has two suits in court right now, but boy, they're fighting him tooth and claw. Mm-hmm. Same thing with James Sanders, who is my partner on the original book and movie. He has an ongoing investigation that, you know, he's been, Freedom of Information Acting these people for years. Right. And sometimes you find that you get these bits of information like that. I couldn't believe the treasure trove of CIA data we got about 10 years ago. These guys, you know, did most of the heavy lifting there. I'm the person who comes in and tells the story. And you're right, though, Doug. What I try to do is to tell the story. So I was having a conversation with my brother yesterday, and he tends to lean left, but he's involved. He knows TW800 well. And he said, you know, you could have sold a lot more copies if you kept the Clintons out of the book, right? I said, but then I wouldn't have a motive, right? You know, then the story doesn't make any sense. I could talk about the technical data all day, but without a larger story, without a larger rationale for this happening, it doesn't make any sense, you know?
Oh man, I don't want to understand this. So you're telling me the motive, the purely political motive. Okay, so if Clinton would have addressed the nation, told the truth, you know, we had a serious error in judgment, a serious error, whatever, serious accident, and we'll make it right. I mean, he could have done that, right? I mean,
he could have, just like Barack Obama could have done it right after Benghazi, but they both panicked. And the parallels here are very strong. They're both running for re-election. And on the night in question, they both went into hiding. No one knows where either one of them was.
Oh, yeah.
And they made the wrong decision. And that decision was to BS the investigation past November, right? Now, they both got away with it because they knew the media would cooperate with them, but Obama more confidently than Clinton. Well, the investigation into TW800 was, well, I could see it was just jerry-rigged, improvised. You could see they're just trying to kick that can down past November, and then they're in the office and they could figure that out. And same thing with Benghazi and Barack Obama. No one still knows where he was the night this all went down, when Hillary Clinton was out front. And then there was that debate with Mitt Romney, which lost Romney the election. And it wasn't really his fault at that town hall debate where Obama is saying that it was a terrorist act right away. He said that, and Romney challenges him. Then Candy Crowley tag teams with And she's a heavyweight, too. You got to watch out for her. She tag teams with Obama. She starts waving a piece of paper saying, yes, he said it was an act of terror. Well, he never said that. But they got away with it. And, you know, for the public who doesn't know any better, they did that. And with Clinton's, it was a harder haul to get it back. Now, I would say that it was political, but only a handful of people would have known that. The rest of the people would have been told, and it would have sounded very credible, that it was a national security issue of the highest order. We were running a test, blah, 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 or whatever. We cannot let this news out for fear that our enemies, X, Y, Y, Z, blah, blah, blah. And they swear people to silence. And, you know, Doug, for instance, last month, I spoke to a group of 40 Navy veterans about this, right? I thought for sure I was going to get a ton of pushback. Because the best question I get asked is, well, if, you know, so many people knew that a missile was fired, why hasn't anyone come forward, right?
Okay, yeah. That's a great question.
I asked my Navy veterans guy this question. And they didn't think it was a great question because they knew no one would come forward, you know? They said, no, they totally understand why no one would come forward. At the brass would lose their pensions, right, for starters. And for pensions is the anchor, keeps them anchored to the orthodoxy, the political line. And for the sailors, they would have feared retribution, and they would have, with good reason. And plus, there was the whole, if you're on a mission that has some classified element to it, you commit a crime by coming forward, you know, you're whistleblowing. And the media only like whistleblowers who advance their agenda. We've seen that over and over again, right?
Did they ultimately, and forgive me for not recalling this, did they classify any information during the investigation?
I would say there is certain information that I don't know that it's classified, but I can tell you that they're resisting sharing it and with tenacity. Even though the people who are asking for it, Tom Stalk up on one hand and Jim Sanders on the other, have every right to that information. It's not, you know, classified beyond their ability to see it. Okay. So they have to find other reasons to deny them their request.
Man, I'll tell you what. I guess looking back, again, 27 years ago, It seems in some ways like a lifetime ago. Well, to some it is, but it seems like just yesterday. The behavior of our federal government in covering up things, the behavior of the intelligence community, how they work together to cover things up. I mean, it's only getting worse today. And like you said, brazenly lying to us and saying, yeah, I mean, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? You know?
Yeah, right. I mean, and now that's exactly what they're saying to those eyewitnesses. Who are you going to believe, us, your official orthodox opinion makers, or your own lying eyes, right? Well, a lot of the eyewitnesses have been very brave, very stalwart, come forward, haven't changed, haven't wavered, and they know what they saw, and they know they've been in a sense, defamed by people who are telling them they were crazy. They didn't know what they were seeing. But on the other hand, Doug, if this had happened today, let's say it happened July 17th today. I mean, forget the history. Forget all we know. Think about us mentally back in that same place, naive and trusting. Well, today, hundreds of people would have captured it on their cell phones, and they would have shared the information all over the internet before they were able to suppress it. In 1996, only about 10% were online. And so the eyewitnesses didn't know there were hundreds of others. They all thought they were kind of unique, or, you know, maybe knew a handful of other people. And, you know, and so what the FBI tried to do was to gaslight them. I mean, literally, into thinking that they were a little nuts, you know, and they weren't quite sure what they were seeing.
Wow.
And they got away with it. It's unfortunate. 27 years later, though, the principals are still around. Bill and Hillary Clinton, Jamie Gorelick, they're still involved. And it would not be a tragedy if they were finally exposed, right? It would be a welcome relief. A lot of the family members are still there. I talk to them routinely. And today is like a day of mourning for that.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course. I would be losing a loved one in that fashion. Frankly, I'd be pissed off. And I'd want the truth. And if I found out that this was really all about politics, and as you mentioned, you know, Greg Norman, okay, yeah, no, we've got to get to the bottom of this. And the people, and you know, Jack, I would bet there are people out there who know the truth that really want, in their heart of hearts, want to tell the truth.
Yes.
But are afraid to. And
right.
Can they contact you? I mean...
They can contact me anytime. The best way to contact me is just through my website, cashel.com, and it'll tell you how to contact Jack.
Okay.
And I'm happy to talk to them. At this point, I need hard information. I mean, it's, I've talked to 100 people. I've talked to 100 people, literally, who said to me, you know, I know someone who was on that ship. You know, that's no longer good enough. I need the person who was on the ship. And I'll say, can you put me in touch with that person? Well, let me check. No, I'm sorry. You know, they don't want to cooperate. I get it. We have one guy who has come forward and he's helpful. He's tried to get his, you know, captain to come forward. And I've seen their exchanges without success. But we need, you know, we really need someone who is in that, what is it called? The CIC, the Combat Information Center.
Yes.
My guy was in his CIC, but he was not on the ship that fired the missile. He was in that group and not on the ship. So his information is a little bit indirect. So that's what we need. And they have to understand that there's more risk involved than there is reward. But as they're, you know, 27 years later, if they're marching, as we all are, towards the end game, you know, why not make go out with a bang, right?
And you know, folks, I want to say this. Out of all of the investigative journalists, authors I know, people I know, Jack Cashel he knows how to keep information confidential. He knows how to work the system in a good way, okay? He knows how to protect people. And I would ask this. I don't know how I know this, but I know that there's somebody out there either who's listening or watching who knows exactly what happened, maybe was on the ship that fired that missile. Hey, may even been part of that missile firing process. Please contact Jack Cashel. Don't waste his time. Don't waste anyone's time. But come clean. I know in your heart of hearts you want to. I know there's somebody out there that will. I really believe that. And in the meantime, grab a hold of Jack Cashel's paperback version of TWA 800 or the hard copy. If you're like me, I love hard copies, hardcover copies. So do that as well as Untenable. Jack, we've got about, about 6-7 minutes left here. I don't want to miss anything. Take it. What haven't we covered?
Well, you know, your appeal is right. I mean, it's exactly what we need right now. I think, you know, one story that I spun out of this, I believe, that is relevant to the news today is the Sandy Berger story. And between 2002 and 2004, Berger made something like 4 trips to the National Archives to retrieve information. This was a dangerous mission for him. He was, and he was jeopardizing not only his career, but his freedom, because what he was going to do is totally illegal. And the archivist caught him secreting out information, stashing it in his socks and his underwear, taking it out to a dump site. They found this at a construction site, storing it there, then taking it back to his home and shredding it after reading it. These were original documents, some of them. I believe there were Bill Clinton's handwritten notes about TWA 800. And those were the only thing that I could think of that was worth risking his career for, let alone his freedom. And you know the consequence of this, right? I mean, at that time, we had an honest archivist who brought that information to the attention of the Department of Justice. At that time, even though it was a Bush White House, this is something people need to understand. Bush did not control the Department of Justice. Trump did not control the Department of Justice. It's a 90% embedded Democratic operation. And all of the people involved that the archivist talked to, four of them, I looked them up, they're all Democratic donors. And they were holdovers from the Clinton administration. And he said, you have got to tell the 9/11 commission about what Berger has been up to before Berger testifies publicly on about 9/11, right? So, and they stonewalled him. They would not let him go forward. So, and he went back to them repeatedly and said, this is crazy. How can you not let them know? You know, there were 10 people on the 9/11 commission, five of them Democrats, five Republicans. The five Republicans, like, you know, Jimmy Stewart character is going, Mr. Smith went to Washington. The five Democrats were all hardball scrabblers, including Jay Mikorelick, right?
Right.
And, you know, someone said to her, hey, you're the person who created the wall. What are you doing on the commission judging anyone else, right? And they would not allow that to go forward. So when Sandy Berger comes to testify, Thomas Keene, who is the head of the commission, Republican softball player from New Jersey, introduced him. Well, thank you for your years of public service, Sandy Berger, you know, selling out American interests to China. He didn't say that. He should have, you know, concealing and suppressing evidence about TW 800. Didn't say that either, but should have. And he went unscathed. And so then finally, the Department of Justice, the Brockfeld, the head of the archive, somehow leaked this and it came out. And as the New York Times described it, it caused a temporary stir. That was their phrase, a temporary stir, when it was revealed that Berger had been in there stealing and shredding, you know, original documents. And the Justice Department recommended a career-shattering fine of $10,000. You
know? Jeez.
And a 3-year suspension of his security clearance would have enabled him to be eligible just in time for the 2008 election campaign, where he could advise, you know, Hillary Clinton. So that's the way they roll. And he got away with that. And the more you know about the things they get away with, and in some sense, the more discouraged you get. But in a sense also, Doug, you get more appreciative of those people who've risked it all to tell the truth and to come forward. And even people like yourselves and I who are, you know, out on the front lines battling every day, and people say, oh, what difference are you making? Well, you know, if in your appeal today, Doug, you get that one guy to come forward, you'll have made a career's worth of difference. So we'll see what happens.
Amen. And even, I like to tell the story about, you know, the little boy in the walking along the shore after the tide went back out and seeing all the starfish struggling on the sand and stepping down, picking up, throwing him back into the water, and older man coming by and saying, you know what, you're not really making any difference. And the little boy looks up and says, I made a difference to that one. I probably slaughtered that story, but the fact is,
the point's well made, right?
You know, we can make that difference. And again, in my heart, look, I've got no basis for saying this, but in my heart, I know that there's somebody listening, watching, or somebody who will tell that person to listen, right, and watch this, folks. Please get a hold of Jack Cashel by way of his website, cashel.com. The link will be in the program description box at HagmanPI.com. And in the meantime, order his book, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy, as well as Untenable. You got to do that, too. Hey, get both at the same time. Jack, I want to thank you so much for being part of today. And I'm praying for the families of the murder victims of 27 years ago.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Doug. I appreciate that. And my heart goes out to those people, too. And well, one day we'll see if we can get some answers.
Amen to that. And if there's anyone to get the answers, I believe it will be you. Jack Cashel, again, one of my favorite people on the planet. Thank you so very much for being part of today, taking time out of your busy schedule. Thank you. Thank you, my friend.
Hey, Doug, anytime.
All right. That'll do it, folks. HagmanPI.com. Don't forget, subscribe, Rumble, and Brighteon. Have a good day.